All right. I rather appreciated your ideas about the subtle insanity which precedes the first drink. That's what has to change. That's what the 12-step program of Alcoholics Anonymous changes, the thinking that precedes the taking of the next first drink. But I was confident it could not happen to me after what I had learned. I reasoned that I was not so far advanced as most of you fellas, that I had been unusually successful in licking my other personal problems, and that I would therefore be successful where you men fail. My thinking exactly for a long time in the beginning of my AA experience is that I wasn't as bad as you people were. I was alcoholic, but not like you. I was basing that on what you said happened to you, and it didn't happen to me, so I wasn't as alcoholic as you were. It's sort of like, you know, in a meeting where they talk about my dog's bigger than your dog. Or, boy, I've been drunker than that.
I've spilled more than you've drunk.
You know, the idea that, I heard a story one time about it. It was in a men's meeting, of course. And they were talking about waking up in the bed. They were so drunk that they woke up in the bed with a woman that they didn't even know. And of course, by the time it got around to the back of the room, my dog's bigger than your dog. It had done got worse. And the young fellow back there said, I've been drunker than that. I woke up in the bed with a man I didn't know. That's what I heard, you know. I heard y'all being dirty, rotten, filthy. I thought that's what it was. And I hadn't done that, so I couldn't identify with you. But I knew the last time I came back, I knew you had something going for you that I wanted. I didn't know what it was. But thank God I could stay dry long enough. I think that's the most important thing about getting sober, is staying dry long enough to get sober, to get free from alcohol.
I believe you identified my problem, Bob. I woke up in the bed one morning with a man I didn't know.
Yeah.
Me.
Yeah. I reasoned I was not so far advanced as most of you fellas, that I had been unusually successful in licking my other personal problems, and that I would therefore be successful where you men failed. I felt I had every right to be self-confident, that it would only be a matter of exercising my willpower and keeping on guard. In this frame of mind, I went about my business, and for a time all was well. I had no trouble refusing drinks, and began to wonder if I had not been making too hard work of a simple matter. You know, I remember leaving the meeting and going home and thinking, I'm not like that. I just made too big a deal out of this. I don't need this. After all, I hadn't drank anything in nearly 40 days. I don't need this. But thank God I kept coming back. One day I went to Washington to present some accounting evidence to a government bureau. I had been out of town before during this particular dry spell, so there was nothing new about that. Physically, he feels fine. Neither did I have any pressing problems or worries. My business came off well. I was pleased and knew my partners would be too. It was the end of a perfect day, not a cloud on the horizon. Everything that can go right for Fred is going right.
He's probably pretty restless, irritable, and discontented.
And he just don't know it. I went to the hotel and leisurely dressed for dinner. As I crossed the squiggly writing, now anytime you see squiggly writing in this book, it's important. As I crossed the threshold of the dining room, the thought came to mind. Now, my body didn't start craving a drink. The thought comes to mind that it would be nice to have a couple of cocktails and go back to the asylum. But that ain't what he's thinking, is it? He's thinking about having a couple of cocktails with dinner. That was all. Nothing more. I ordered a cocktail. He made a decision and acted on it, see. This time, the alcohol's not going to bother him, so he ordered him a cocktail and his meal. Then I ordered another cocktail. After dinner, I decided to take a walk. When I returned to the hotel, it struck me a highball would be fine before going to bed. So I stepped into the bar and had one.
I believe this is the allergy now.
Yep, he's triggered the allergy now. I remember having several more that night and plenty the next morning. Alcoholic, intoxicated behavior. I have a shadowy recollection of being in an airplane bound for New York and of finding a friendly taxi cab driver at the landing field instead of my wife. Wonder why his wife didn't come get him. The driver escorted me about for several days. Now, he's drunk. Intoxicated behavior. He's out riding around with a cab driver, probably just riding around and drinking.
That's not insane. That's just intoxicated behavior.
That's right. That's intoxicated behavior. I know little of where I went or what I said and did. Then came the hospital with the unbearable mental and physical suffering. As soon as I regained my ability to think,
when the alcohol got out of his system,
I went carefully over that evening in Washington. Not only had I been off guard, I had made no fight whatever against the first drink. This time I had not thought of the consequences at all. Now, old Jim did kind of think he was not being too smart, but Fred didn't think about none of it. I had commenced to drink as carelessly as though the cocktails were ginger ale. I now remember what my alcoholic friends had told me, how they prophesied that if I had an alcoholic mind, the time and place would come, I would drink again. They had said that though I did raise a defense, it would one day give way before some trivial reason for having a drink. Well, just that did happen and more. But what I had learned of alcoholism did not occur to me at all. I knew from that moment that I had an alcoholic mind. I saw that willpower and self-knowledge would not help in these strange mental blank spots. I had never been able to understand people who said that a problem had them hopelessly defeated. I knew then it was a crushing blow. Two of the members of Alcoholics Anonymous came to see me. They grinned, which I didn't like so much, and then asked me if I thought myself alcoholic and if I were really licked this time. They ask him to concede to his innermost self that he is an alcoholic. I had to concede both propositions. They piled on me heaps of evidence to the effect that an alcoholic mentality, such as I had exhibited in Washington, was a hopeless condition. They cited cases out of their own experience by the dozen. They told them about how they were powerless over alcohol. This process snuffed out all the last flicker of conviction that I could do the job myself. Then they outlined the spiritual answer and program of action which 100 of them had followed successfully. Though I had been only a nominal churchman, their proposals were not intellectually hard to swallow. But the program of action, though entirely sensible, was pretty drastic, simple but not easy. It meant I would have to throw several lifelong conceptions out of the window. That was not easy. But the moment I made up my mind to go through with the process, I had the curious feeling that my alcoholic condition was relieved, as in fact it proved to be. Quite as important was the discovery that spiritual principles would solve all my problems. It took me a long time to understand that. Spiritual principles will solve all my problems. The truth will solve all my problems. Seek ye the truth, and the truth will set you free. It'll probably make you angry to start with, but it will set you free. I have since brought into a way of living infinitely more satisfying, and I hope more useful than the life I lived before. My old manner of life was no means a bad one. He didn't have a bad life at all. But I would not exchange its best moments for the worst I have now. I would not go back to it even if I could. Fred's story speaks for itself. We hope it strikes home to thousands like him. He had felt only the first nip of the ringer. Who all knows what he's talking about, nip of the ringer? Raise your hand. Let's see. All right, nip of the ringer. Now he's talking about an old washing machine where it had the ringer where you put the clothes up there and it rings them out, and if you wasn't real careful, you'd get your finger caught in there, and you could get your whole arm caught up in that ringer. Most alcoholics have to be pretty badly mangled before they really commence to solve their problems. Many doctors and psychiatrists agree with our conclusions. One of these men, staff member of a world-renowned hospital, recently made this statement to some of us. What you say about the general hopelessness of the average alcoholic's plight is, in my opinion, correct. As to two of you men whose stories I have heard, there is no doubt in my mind that you were 100% hopeless, apart from divine help. Had you offered yourself as patients at this hospital, I would not have taken you if I had been able to avoid it. People like you are too heartbreaking. Though not a religious person, I have profound respect for the spiritual approach in such cases as yours. For most cases, there is virtually no other solution. Once more, they tell me that this is the fourth time he's told us this. I haven't gone back and found it, but I know that we've been told this before several times. The alcoholic, at certain times, has no effective mental defense against the first drink. Except in a few rare cases, neither he nor any other human being can provide such a defense. His defense must come from a higher power. Now, it had to be explained to me why it had to come from a higher power. It's because my own mind cannot fix my own mind. If the problem is in my mind, then the solution won't be in there. The solution has to come from somewhere else. And we're given a plan, program of action to bring about that solution. And now, we're all the way over here to chapter 4. Are we going too fast, Bud?
Well, I don't know. We've got a lot to do, but I believe we're pretty much right where we're supposed to be.
Doing what we're supposed to be doing.
I expect so.
Yeah.
You've told me that I can't heal a sick mind with a sick mind, and that I can't think my way out of this problem. And so, up until now, we've been looking at information that is designed to allow my thinking to be changed a little bit. I looked in the dictionary, and I saw where will means thinking. And my will is, which I'm going to try to decide to turn over to the care of the God of my understanding, is what my problem is. So my thinking is being changed a little bit as I can see the truth in here and get rid of my fixed ideas and the thinking that I've carried with me that has kept me so sick for so long. So, and this is laid out in a very important sequence to bring about certain ideas in a specific order, so that I can learn what I need to know in order to take some steps to get better. They're probably going to tell us again what our problem is. And we're going to read a chapter to the agnostics. And I've gotten some valuable information from Joe and Charlie about this. And the most important definition that they've given me is that this word simply means without knowledge. It doesn't mean that I don't believe. It simply means that I don't know. And I'm beginning to understand now that that's my biggest problem, is I suffer from a disease of ignorance. But I just did not know what God could do for me, because I had, as I've already told you, I didn't need God. I didn't need the God of your understanding. I didn't need the God of your church. I had something that was working pretty well for me. And in most other areas of my life, my thinking seemed to be pretty normal. I was able to do my job and some other things. But I can't make a decision based on my old fixed ideas. I've got to have some new ideas, and I've got to have a little bit of knowledge. So, in the preceding chapters, you have learned something of alcoholism. We hope we have made clear the distinction between the alcoholic and the non-alcoholic. If, when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely, or if when drinking you have little control over the amount you take, you are probably alcoholic. If that be the case, you may be suffering from an illness which only a spiritual experience will conquer. Now, they said that I was probably an alcoholic, and they said that I was suffering from an illness, that I may be suffering from an illness. Now, I know that I most definitely am an alcoholic, and that was my only hope. But those are the two questions that I have to answer. I don't need to really get into behavior. and I don't need to, at this point, worry about my upbringing, my inner child, my psyche, and how it's been damaged. Of course it's been damaged when I've been living in a situation where I was unable to see the truth. But the first thing I need to do is to recover from the disease that's killing me, and then I'll be equipped with some power to deal with all those areas where I've been damaged, possibly. But these two questions, if when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely, that's the obsession of the mind, or if when drinking, you have little control over the amount you take, that's the physical allergy, then I am most definitely an alcoholic. To one who feels he is an atheist, that's one who has no power to turn to. And I believe at times an atheist might have a little bit easier time with this than someone who thinks he knows but yet doesn't, like me. For agnostics, such an experience seems impossible. But to continue as he is means disaster, especially if he is an alcoholic of the hopeless variety. To be doomed to an alcoholic death,
step one,
or to live on a spiritual basis,
step two,
are not always easy alternatives to face. But it isn't so difficult. About half our original fellowship were of exactly that type. At first, some of us tried to avoid the issue, hoping against hope we were not true alcoholics. But after a while, we had to face the fact that we must find a spiritual basis of life, or else. Perhaps it is going to be that way with you. But cheer up. Something like half of us thought we were atheists or agnostics. Our experience shows that you need not be disconcerted. If a mere code of morals or a better philosophy of life were sufficient to overcome alcoholism, many of us would have recovered long ago. Now, I wondered what that meant for a long time, and I had already talked about a list of rules. And now I believe that's what they're talking about. A mere code of morals means a list of truths. And it would do no good for you to list the truth for me. I have to seek the truth and understand it for myself. But we found that such codes and philosophies did not save us, no matter how much we tried. We could wish to be moral. We could wish to be philosophically comforting. In fact, we could will these things with all our might, but the needed power wasn't there. Our human resources, as marshaled by the will or by my thinking, were not sufficient. They failed utterly. Now, from this point on, we're not going to talk about alcohol too much. We're going to talk about our thinking. Lack of power, that was our dilemma. Step one, that's the problem. We had to find a power by which we could live. Step two, that's the solution. And it had to be a power greater than ourselves, obviously. But where and how were we to find this power? If I had had the power, I would have certainly used it. At some point when I was sober, I would have decided that I no longer wanted to treat my family and friends the way I was, and I would have just quit drinking. So I obviously do not have the power to have this obsession removed. Well, that's exactly what this book is about. And there's another one of them exactlys, them precisely's, those absolutely. This is the reason for this book. It is not necessarily for my entertainment. It is to save my life. Its main object is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself which will solve your problem.
I tell you what I'd like for us to do right now is we're on page 45 and just sort of pinch your book up and go over to page 85. 40 pages. And if we're willing to do and begin practicing the principles that are explained in those 40 pages, we're going to recover from alcoholism. There's been books written ad infinitum about alcoholism. And if we've come to the conclusion that we're powerless over alcohol, and if we've come to suspect that a power greater than ourselves can restore us to right thinking about alcohol, these next 40 pages are going to give us a program that's going to relieve us of the disease of alcoholism. A simple but not easy program. A program of self. All right.
That means we have written a book which we believe to be spiritual as well as moral. And it means, of course, that we are going to talk about God. Here difficulty arises with agnostics. Many times we talk to a new man and watch his hope rise as we discuss his alcoholic problem and explain our fellowship. But his face falls when we speak of spiritual matters, especially when we mention God. for we have reopened subject which our man thought he had neatly evaded or entirely ignored. And it's important for me to understand, just as I could not understand my God, I certainly can't understand another man's God. So therefore, I don't need to be worried about how much I talk about God, whether I run him out there, because Charlie told me that Lickard run his butt right back in here. So I need to carry the message as I know it to be true for myself. Let's turn the page to 46, and in the first full paragraph, we read, "Yes, we of agnostic temperament have had these thoughts and experiences. Let us make haste to reassure you. We found that as soon as we were able to lay aside prejudice and express even a willingness to believe in a power greater than ourselves, we commenced to get results, even though it was impossible for any of us to fully define or comprehend that power, which was God." Now, this is what's happening as I come to suspect that there's a power that will restore me to sanity. They're talking about step two here. Step two is actually what will eventually happen to me if I will do all the rest of the steps. That's the solution.
I read in the pamphlet of an alcoholic's view of Alcoholics Anonymous, he made the statement in there that when he quit trying to find a God that he could understand and began to accept a God that understood him, he was home free. And that set me free, because I didn't understand God. I thought they were asking me to know more about God than I could possibly know. But I had to come to the conclusion that there was a God that understood me. If he made me, if he put me together, if he made a human being, then he ought to understand me, and I'm going to let him run the show.
He ought to know how to fix it if he
might. Yeah, if he broke it, if I broke it, he ought to know how to fix it.
That's exactly right. And I know now that my understanding of God was no understanding at all. So that was the point where I was when it came time to make a decision. No understanding is an understanding. That can be an individual's understanding of God. Much to our relief, we discovered we did not need to consider another's conception of God. Our own conception, however inadequate, was sufficient to make the approach and to effect a contact with him. As soon as we admitted the possible existence of a creative intelligence, a spirit of the universe, underlying the totality of things, we began to be possessed of a new sense of power and direction, provided we took other simple steps. That would be a decision and some action. We found that God does not make too hard terms with those who seek him. To us, the realm of spirit is broad, roomy, all-inclusive, never exclusive or forbidding to those who earnestly seek. It is open, we believe, to all men.
All the churches that I ever went to, searching this, looking for this power greater than myself, it seemed to me like they put God in a box. You know, if you do these things, and if you do it this way, and if you do it consistently, then God will talk to you, God will take care of you. And I couldn't do those things, or wasn't doing those things, I had no intentions of doing those things, so I couldn't have a God. And I come here, and they said, God, as you understand God, and you can start wherever you are. It doesn't make any difference if you're just willing to be willing to suspect that there might be a power greater than yourself. That's what I like about step two. It says we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to right thinking. It don't. There's a gentleman that's in with the unlikely name of Father Bill Wilson, a Catholic priest, and he said he spent most of his life interpreting and studying religious and spiritual writings. And he said the only piece of religious or spiritual writing that had ever made any significant change in his life was the chapter We Agnostics in the big book Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said the reason that it does is there's nowhere in there does it try to convince me that there is a God. It simply says if I am willing to be willing to suspect that there might be and do these things based on that faith, God will show up for me in my life, and I believe that's true. When therefore we speak to you of God, we mean your own conception of God. This applies too to other spiritual expressions which you find in this book. Do not let any prejudice you may have against spiritual terms deter you from honestly asking yourself what they mean to me. I believe this is a program of self. What does this mean to me? At the start, this was all we needed to commence spiritual growth, to affect our first conscious relation with God as we understood Him. Afterward, we found ourselves accepting many things which then seemed entirely out of reach. That was growth. But if we wished to grow, we had to begin somewhere. So we used our own conception, however limited it was. We needed to ask ourselves but one short question. Now, this is an agnostic thinking. Do I now believe, or am I even willing to believe, that there is a power greater than myself? As soon as a man can say that he does believe, or is willing to believe, we emphatically assure him that he is on his way. If he already believes in, but not necessarily that, a power greater than himself will restore him to sanity, it's agnostic thinking. If he's an atheist and he's willing to be willing to believe, it's still open to him. It has been repeatedly proven among us that upon this simple cornerstone, a wonderfully effective spiritual structure can be built. Now see, here's the last page of going back there and looking at the spiritual experience. Well, we've already looked at it, so we won't be necessary to look at it again. That was great news for us, for we had assumed we could not make use of spiritual principles unless we accepted many things on faith which seemed difficult to believe. When people presented us with spiritual approaches, how frequently did we all say, "I wish I had what that man has. I'm sure it would work if I could only believe as he believes. But I cannot accept as surely true the many articles of faith which are so plain to him."
If I do what he does.
Yeah, if I do what he does. Now, I thought when I could not or did not believe as you believed, I thought I was inadequate. When I didn't have the faith that you said you had, I was inadequate, and I wasn't worthy of any kind of recovery. And people told me all the time, and all my life they've said, you have to have faith. And I don't reckon I ever did, but I always wanted to ask them, how do you do that? How do you have faith? You know, and they would say something like, well, you just have to believe. You have to believe more deeply. You need to do this. You're doing the wrong thing. And I couldn't, you can't have faith if you don't know how to have faith. And Alcoholics Anonymous gave me a definition of faith. They said faith is the result of a course of action taken that I suspect might work. That told me, I can't just have faith like having a hangover. I have to do something to have the faith. I have to follow a course of action that I just suspect might work. Step two does not say I came to know that a power greater than myself would restore me to sanity. It says, I came to believe, and another definition of believe is simply suspect. I came to suspect that some kind of power greater than myself could restore me to right thinking about alcohol, restore me to right thinking, the thinking that precedes the taking of the next first drink.
You want to rest a spell?
Mm-hmm.
All right. I can't know God, just like Bob had said. So this is only asking me to become willing to believe. And I have all my life needed to have answers. So I'm automatically thinking that I need to have more answers than I really need at this time. I need to stay ahead and I need to stay caught up. And I've got a keen alcoholic intellectual mind that insists that I already know a little something about God, because after all, I've been educated in four or five different churches. But the truth is that I did not have the knowledge. I just did not know. And contempt prior to investigation, meaning the only thing that will keep me from learning what I need to know is what I think I already know, if it's inaccurate. So that's important for me to understand, is that it's not time to identify God yet, only to be thinking about whether God might solve my problems or the any power greater than me. On page 48, it says the reader may still ask why he should believe in a power greater than himself. We think there are good reasons. Let us have a look at some of them. The practical individual of today is a stickler for facts and results. Nevertheless, the 20th century readily accepts theories of all kinds, provided they are firmly grounded in fact. We have numerous theories, for example, about electricity. Everybody believes them without a murmur of doubt. Why this ready acceptance? Simply because it is impossible to explain what we see, feel, direct, and use without a reasonable assumption as a starting point. Now, we accept things on faith all the time. And Charlie talks about the light switch. When we walk in a room and most of us turn on a light switch, then the lights come on, and that is what happens when we turn on the light switch. We don't really think about the power involved, where it comes from, how it gets through the wires, and all that stuff. We just accept it. It says, everybody nowadays believes in scores of assumptions for which there is good evidence, but no perfect visual proof. And that was an example that I had just given you. And does not science demonstrate that visual proof is the weakest proof? It is being constantly revealed as mankind studies the material world that outward appearances are not inward reality at all. To illustrate, the prosaic steel girder is a mass of electrons whirling around each other at incredible speed. These tiny bodies are governed by precise laws, and these laws hold true throughout the material world. Science tells us so. We have no reason to doubt it. When, however, the perfectly logical assumption is suggested that underneath the material world and life as we see it, there is an all-powerful, guiding, creative intelligence, right there our perverse streak comes to the surface, and we laboriously set out to convince ourselves it isn't so. We read wordy books and indulge in windy arguments, thinking we believe this universe needs no God to explain it. Were our contentions true, it would follow that life originated out of nothing, means nothing, and proceeds nowhere. Now, what happens here is that they gave me one example, and I understood it. But the next example is something that I don't understand, the atoms whirling around in the girder. But they're going to give an example, hopefully, so that everyone might understand what they're trying to talk about. At the bottom of the page, it says, We who have traveled this dubious path beg you to lay aside prejudice, even against organized religion. Now, that was hard for me to do, but I can see now where I truly need to do it. Religion never caused me any problem. The only thing was my reaction to it. I learned to react poorly to it a long time ago, and I continued to have a worse reaction as time went on. So we have learned that whatever the human frailties of various faiths may be, those faiths have given purpose and direction to millions. People of faith have a logical idea of what life is all about. Actually, we used to have no reasonable conception whatever. We used to amuse ourselves by cynically dissecting spiritual beliefs and practices when we might have observed that many spiritually minded persons of all races, colors, and creeds were demonstrating a degree of stability, happiness, and usefulness which we should have sought ourselves. In other words, instead of doing so much talking, I might have just been looking around and making some observations. This is about observations, but I cannot even learn to make observations until I have an idea that I don't already know. I have got to know that I don't know, or I'm not even going to look around. On page 51, it says, this world of ours has made more material progress in the last century than in all the millenniums which went before. And they're talking about a century that's almost a century ago. So think about what's happened in the 60 years since then. Almost everyone knows the reason. Students of ancient history tell us that the intellect of men in those days was equal to the best of today. Yet in ancient times, material progress was painfully slow. The spirit of modern scientific inquiry, research, and invention was almost unknown. In the realm of the material, men's minds were fettered by superstition, tradition, and all sorts of fixed ideas. Some of the contemporaries of Columbus thought a round earth preposterous, and others came near putting Galileo to death for his astronomical heresies. And this is what is happening to me. I am full of tradition, I am full of fixed ideas, and I become superstitious when I can't understand what's going on and I can't see the truth. So that's what's keeping me from learning what I need to know. The men's intellect was certainly as good as the intellect of today, but in times past, it was not popular to believe certain things. It's not popular to believe certain things today. We, of course, want to believe what's trendy. I know my children want to wear what's trendy. They want to talk in trendy terms and things like that. And, of course, we're all that way to a certain extent. But in times past, they would cut your head off if you didn't think the way they wanted you to think. And they blamed it on religion. They blamed it on politics, just as I think incorrectly and blame it on things that I, and blame it on whatever. But nevertheless, people's minds were fettered by superstition and the absolute law that they not think a certain way. And it still works today. I just need to look at what is instead of being bound up by what I think. And fixed ideas are still beginning to fall away. I'm going to, in the interest of time, I'm going to go to page 53.
Just a minute, Butch. We've got to tell the Columbus story.
Well, tell about Columbus.
I'm going to tell you the Columbus story right quick.
Mm-hmm.
Columbus, for some reason, you know, the world at that time was fettered with superstition, tradition, and all sorts of fixed ideas. And one of the fixed ideas was that the earth was flat. That if you went out so far, you'd sail off the end, and that'd be the end of you. But Columbus, for some reason, suspected that it was round. He thought you could go west by sailing east. And he talked this lady into giving him enough money to buy him some ships. And he set out to prove that the earth was round. Now, he just suspected. He didn't know for sure. He suspected it was round. So on his maiden voyage, he had this guy hired to go out on the bow of the ship, the front of the ship, and listen for any rushing, falling water that he might hear, you know. So just in case he's coming up on the edge of this thing and it really was flat, they could turn around and go back. But they went on and they found what he thought was in the... They found the other world. And on his way back the second time, see, he cut that guy off because he didn't need him no longer. He didn't suspect any longer that the earth was round. He had faith that it was round, and he knew that it was round. And they said that Columbus must have been an alcoholic, you know, because when he went on his trip, he didn't know where he was going. And when he got there, he didn't know where he was. And when he got back, he had no idea where he'd been. And a woman paid for the whole trip. All right, Butch, finish this up.
Well, we don't know whether we're going too fast or going too slow, but we'll find out after a while. It says, logic is great stuff. We liked it. We still like it, and I don't believe there's anything wrong with it. It is not by chance we were given the power to reason, to examine the evidence of our senses, and to draw conclusions. That is one of man's magnificent attributes. We agnostically inclined would not feel satisfied with a proposal which does not lend itself to reasonable approach and interpretation. Hence we are at pains to tell why we think our present faith is reasonable, why we think it more sane and logical to believe than not to believe, why we say our former thinking was soft and mushy when we threw up our hands in doubt and said, we don't know. When we became alcoholics, crushed by a self-imposed crisis we could not postpone or evade, we had to fearlessly face the proposition that either God is everything or else He is nothing. God either is or He isn't. What was our choice to be? And I believe that we, myself, in my need to please people and to allow people to have it the way they want it, I grew up in the tourist business, and people were usually right. Unless they had physically hurt me somehow, they usually couldn't insult me too badly. That's just the way I was trained to be. But in my need to try to make people happy, I have even tried to create places for people to stay when they did not want to go back to step one, and they were not, and they did not want to face step two. I tried to find loopholes for them so that they could wallow in some place in the middle and not be faced with these decisions and not be faced with this paragraph right here. And I understand now that many, many times in this fellowship, I have played God big time, and I have done some wrong, but in so doing, I've learned a whole lot. But, you know, back in the beginning, there was only two places to go, either step one or step two. And let me not create a third place for someone to be uncomfortable and not be going to one of those other places. On page 55, it says, "Yet we had been seeing another kind of flight, a spiritual liberation from this world, people who rose above their problems. They said God made these things possible, and we only smiled. We had seen spiritual release, but liked to tell ourselves it wasn't true." And I can relate to that. I had seen it and did not recognize it. I had not awakened to the fact yet. Actually, we were fooling ourselves, for deep down in every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. It may be obscured by calamity, yes, by pomp, of course, by worship of other things, but in some form or other it is there. For faith in a power greater than ourselves and miraculous demonstrations of that power in human lives are facts as old as man himself. We finally saw that faith in some kind of God was a part of our makeup just as much as the feeling we have for a friend. Sometimes we had to search fearlessly, but he was there. He was as much a fact as we were. We found the great reality deep down within us. In the last analysis, it is only there that he may be found. It was so with us. If we can only clear the ground a bit, if our testimony, that's the first 100 and the stories they're giving us, helps sweep away prejudice, enables you to think honestly, encourages you to search diligently within yourself, then if you wish, you can join us on the broad highway. With this attitude, you cannot fail. The consciousness of your belief is sure to come to you. In other words, with a slightly open mind and a little bit of willingness, there is no way to fail. And they're going to review again. In this book, you will read the experience of a man who thought he was an atheist. His story is so interesting that some of it should be told now. His change of heart was dramatic, convincing, and moving. Our friend was a minister's son. He attended church school, where he became rebellious at what he thought an overdose of religious education. For years thereafter, he was dogged by trouble and frustration. Business, failure, insanity, fatal illness, suicide. These calamities in his immediate family embittered and depressed him and ultimately gave him excuses for his alcoholism. Whoops, that's not in there, is it? Post-war disillusionment, ever more serious alcoholism, impending mental and physical collapse brought him to the point of self-destruction. One night when confined in a hospital, he was approached by an alcoholic who had known a spiritual experience. Our friend's gorge rose as he bitterly cried out, "If there is a God, he certainly hasn't done anything for me." He can't see the truth. But later, alone in his room, he asked himself this question: "Is it possible that all the religious people I have known are wrong?" While pondering the answer, he felt as though he lived in hell. Then, like a thunderbolt, a great thought came. It crowded out all else. "Who are you to say there is no God?" This man recounts that he tumbled out of bed to his knees. In a few seconds, he was overwhelmed by a conviction of the presence of God. It poured over and through him with the certainty and majesty of a great tidal flood. The barriers he had built through years were swept away. He stood in the presence of infinite power and love. He had stepped from bridge to shore. For the first time, he lived in conscious companionship with his Creator. In other words, his fixed ideas were removed quickly. Thus was our friend's cornerstone fixed in place. No later vicissitude had shaken it. His alcoholic problem was taken away. That very night, years ago, it disappeared. Save for a few brief moments of temptation, the thought of drink has never returned. And at such times, a great revulsion has risen up in him. Seemingly, he could not drink even if he would. God had restored his sanity. What is this but a miracle of healing? Yet its elements are simple. Circumstances made him willing to believe. He humbly offered himself to his Maker. Then he knew. Even so has God restored us all to our right minds. To this man the revelation was sudden. Some of us grow into it more slowly. But he has come to all who have earnestly sought him. When we drew near to him, he disclosed himself to us. So I have to do something first. I have to become willing, and then I have to take some action. And based on a suspicion, just barely suspect, that something can be different. And when I do something, it will be different.
You want to take a break or start out?
Yeah, I guess we might as well go to lunch, hadn't we? We'll come back.
Oh, that's right.
Okay.
We'll go to lunch and come back about 1 o'clock. That'll give us an hour and a half. And if that suits you.
Alcoholism had damaged my perspective on some things. And I was trying to talk to my kids one time about perspective. And I used this story about Zeke and Abe. Zeke and Abe used to go to the ball games, and they'd get drunk and come out and forget where their car was, and they couldn't find their car. Now, I've actually lost one car and never did find it. And I lost another one, and it was 2 or 3 or 4 days before I found that one. So Zeke decided that he would come up with a solution to this problem. So he went out and bought a camel. And he said, now there's no way that we're going to be able to, we'll lose this camel. So we'll ride the camel to the ball games, and when we come out, we'll find the camel, get on it, and come home. And Abe said, I don't know about that, but we'll see. So they go to the ball game, and they go in there, and they get drunk as usual. And during that time, there was another venue next door, a Coliseum, and the circus came to town. And they unloaded a whole boxcar full of camels and tied them up right there next to Zeke and Abe's. So they came out, and they had a problem they could see. But Zeke thought that he had really messed up, and he said, oh, Lord, we'll never find our camel. And Abe said, oh, yeah, said, we'll find the camel. So Abe goes down through there lifting up their tails. He walks on down through there lifting up their tails. And Zeke says, now, how in the world are you going to find our camel by looking under their tails? And he said, well, it's easy. Didn't you hear that feller say when we rode in here, look at them two assholes on that camel? So it's just my perspective that's damaged, but it can be repaired.
Keen intellectual alcoholic minds. Chapter 5, how it works. When I first came to AA, I thought the program started right here. Chapter 5, step 4. They said go to chapter 5 and you can read how it works, and that's what it says, how it works. And I didn't know you needed to know this other information before you got to chapter 5, but I went to chapter 5 and read that, and then I read where it said we made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves, and I set out to make a searching and fearless moral inventory, and you could have put the truth of that inventory on a matchbox cover. But it did something, because I didn't get drunk, and I must have stayed sober long enough to hear what you're supposed to do, and finally got it done. There was a guy that came to the Big Book study in Albany, the first one Joe and Charlie had in Georgia, and his name was Travis Cousins, I believe. Yeah. Travis Cousins. Anyway, he had a little AA piece of literature, a newspaper that they put out in England. And the mast of the headline said, AA has never been tried and found wanting. AA has never been tried and found lacking. It's been found difficult and never tried. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. Usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunates. They are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Now, there's several things of interest in that first paragraph. Rarely have we seen a person failed who has thoroughly followed our path. One path. Not followed our paths, but just one path, one course of action. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. Give themselves to the program. Do what the black words say to do. Usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living. Grasping and developing now, not having and holding, but grasping and developing. Growing. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. Now, I read that personally as if you have decided you've got what we've got, which is the disease of alcoholism, and you want what we have to offer, which is sobriety, freedom from alcohol, then you are ready to take certain steps. At some of these we barked. At some of these we barked. At most of them I barked. We thought we could find an easier, softer way. Don't drink and go to meetings. But we could not. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nihil until we let go absolutely. Remember that we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, and powerful. Without help, it is too much for us, but there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Half measures availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. We ask his protection and care with complete abandon. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. I remember for a long time, you know, people talked about getting on their knees and asking God to keep them sober in the morning and thanking God for keeping them sober at night. And I wrote in my book here, I got on my knees and asked God to relieve me of my alcoholism, and he answered, "Get up out of the floor, fat boy, and take these steps that the other guys took. Here are the steps they took, and here are the steps that you'll have to take." Number one, in the summary of the steps of the program of recovery of Alcoholics Anonymous, these steps as they're numbered are a summary of the program itself. We've studied in the past 60 pages how we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Now, the summary of the step requires us to admit we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Because we're powerless over alcohol, our lives are not manageable. If you can't drink and you can't quit, then your life is going to be unmanageable by you. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Is the solution step. Step one is the problem. Step two is the solution. Step three is a decision to do something about the way we think about drinking. Made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. That's our first contact with a power greater than ourselves. We made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. We made a fact-finding, they made a fact-finding, fact-facing, true inventory of the way they thought about drinking. Admitted to God for forgiveness, to ourselves for honesty, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. The admission to the other human being was for humility, for teachability, not humiliation. But for humility, to teach the other human being, to teach me more of the truth about myself. And that's another contact with God as we understand God. We're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings. Another contact. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9, make direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admit it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for the knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. That God, as we understood God, must have been important because they put it in there twice. Having had a spiritual awakening, a psychic change, a personality change sufficient to stay sober, as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Many of us exclaimed, "What an order! I can't go through with it." Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. One of the most important sentences, I believe, in the entire program is, "We are not saints. They weren't in the beginning, and we ain't subject to be, I don't believe." The point is that we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic, what they've been doing since we read the doctor's opinion, we read the medical description of the alcoholic, and then we read the individual description of alcoholics in Bill's story, and there is a solution, and we agnostics. The chapter to the agnostic and our personal adventures before and after make clear three pertinent ideas. Now, if you remember over in the doctor's opinion, it says we can't see the truth. We couldn't see the truth about the way we drink. Now, here comes the truth, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. C, that God could and would if he were sought. A, B, C. Accept, begin, and continue. Being convinced, we were at step 3. And I was at Gym City one night, and I don't know, for some reason I must have been listening, but we had this new guy, or a guy that just accidentally read more than we had outlined on that sheet of paper, because he read that being convinced we were at step 3, and I heard it. And I started thinking, now where did we take step 1 and step 2? I don't remember. The squiggly writing says that we took step 1. I remember the thing that said being convinced, that we had taken step 1, but I don't remember it reading like being convinced we were at step 3. Step 1 and 2 then became convictions of my own mind. They weren't working steps or steps that I take. They were steps that I became convinced of in my own way and in my own mind. Being convinced we were at step 3, which is that we decided to turn our will and our life over to God as we understood Him. Just what do we mean by that, and just what do we do? The first requirement is that we be convinced that any life run on self-will, self-thinking, can hardly be a success. On that basis, we are almost always in collision with something or somebody, even though our motives are good. Most people try to live by self-propulsion. Each person is like an actor who wants to run the whole show, is forever trying to arrange the lights, the ballet, the scenery, and the rest of the players in his own way. If his arrangements would only stay put, if only people would do as he wished, the show would be great. Everybody, including himself, would be pleased. Life would be wonderful. In trying to make these arrangements, our actor may sometimes be quite virtuous. He may be kind, considerate, patient, generous, even modest and self-sacrificing. On the other hand, he may be mean, egotistical, selfish, and dishonest. But as with most humans, he is more likely to have varied traits. Now, this was explained to me this way. I thought that because I had a script that called for me to be the star of the show, if I'm the star of the show, then you have to be the supporting cast. And the supporting cast always does what the star wants them to do. And if they would just do that, then the star would have a real good, you know, everything would be just fine. Because I'd have you doing what I wanted you to do and what I needed for you to do, and I could do what I wanted to. But the only problem with that is everybody, when they're born and start growing up, they have a script also. And in their script, they're the star, and I'm the supporting cast. And we were always in collision, because you can't have two stars. It just don't work that way. What usually happens, the show doesn't come off very well. He begins to think life doesn't treat him right. He decides to exert himself more. He's got a problem here, see, and he can't solve it. And the harder he tries to solve it, the worse the problem becomes. The worse the problem becomes, the harder he tries to solve it, and he has a dilemma. He has a problem that he simply cannot solve. He becomes, on the next occasion, still more demanding or gracious, as the case may be. Still, the play does not suit him. Admitting he may be somewhat at fault, that's rare, he is sure that other people are more to blame. He becomes angry, indignant, self-pitying. He's restless, irritable, and discontented. What is his basic problem? What is his basic trouble? Is he not really a self-seeker even when trying to be kind? Is he not a victim of the delusion that he can wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this world if he only manages well? It is not evident to all the rest of the players, is it not evident to all the rest of the players, that these are the things he wants? And do not his actions make each of them wish to retaliate, snatching all they can get out of the show? Is he not, even in his best moments, a producer of confusion rather than harmony? Our actor is self-centered, egocentric, as people like to call it nowadays. He is like the retired businessman who lolls in the Florida sunshine in the winter complaining of the sad state of the nation, the minister who sighs over the sins of the 20th century, politicians and informers who are sure that all would be utopia if the rest of the world would only behave, the outlaw safecracker who thinks society has wronged him, and the alcoholic who has lost all and is locked up. Whatever our protestations are, not most of us concerned with ourselves, our resentment, our own self-pity. The exact nature of the cause of restlessness, irritability, and discontent, selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles. Driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity, we step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate. Sometimes they hurt us, seemingly without provocation, but we invariably find that at some time in the past, we have made decisions based on self which later placed us in a position to be hurt. So our troubles, we think, are basically of our own making. They arise out of ourself, and the alcoholic is an extreme example of self-will run right, though he usually doesn't think so. Above everything, we alcoholics must be rid of this selfishness. We must, or it kills us. God makes that possible. And there often seems no way of entirely getting rid of self without his help, his aid. Many of us have had moral and philosophical convictions galore, but we could not live up to them, even though we would have liked to. We didn't have the power to live up to those moral convictions. Neither could we reduce our self-centeredness much by wishing or trying on our own power. We had to have God's help. We had to have God's help. My own mind can't fix my own mind. My own self-centered mind can't get rid of my own self-centered fear. Self-centered fear is no more and no less than the fear of losing what I already have, the fear of not gaining what I think I want or need, and the fear of being found out. And that was brought home to me as clear as anything I ever had when I got into this problem that I was having. And I was at 3 o'clock in the morning when I had those old fear thoughts, and I couldn't sleep, and I was looking out the window begging God again to take this fear from me. And I said, "You got to take this fear, take this fear, take this fear." Then I started cussing, you know, "Take this goddamn fear. You've got to take it, because it's killing me. I can't make it for this fear." And I got quiet, and the thought came to me that it's the same self-centered fear that's the root of all my problems. The fear of losing what I already had, which was my life, and the fear of not gaining what I thought I was supposed to have, all that vacation time and retired time, and the fear of being found out for the wimp that I really am. The fear of being found out by people in AA just how scared I was. But that doesn't bother me anymore, because I understand that that was a normal, natural fear, but I was letting it rule my life. It wasn't so much having the fear, it was the way I was letting it, the way I reacted to it. Not what happened, not having the fear, but the way I reacted to the fear. This is the how and why of it. First of all, we had to quit playing God. That's what we make a decision to do, to turn our will, our thinking, and therefore our actions over to the care of God, so we can quit playing God. And when I first read that, I thought, that doesn't pertain to me, because I'm not a God player. I don't play God. But of course I did. Of course I did. It didn't work. Next, we decided that hereafter in this drama of life, God is going to be our director. He is the principal. We are His agents. He is the Father, and we are His children. Most good ideas are simple, and this concept was the keystone of the new and triumphant arch which we passed to freedom. Bill is building a structure here, and the keystone is the rock that holds the archway together. It's the one that makes it stick. And he said that this concept, this idea, is the keystone of the new and triumphant arch through which we pass to freedom. Butch?
Thank you. Self. I think I need to understand what self is. We're talking an awful lot about it. Self-fear, self-centered fear, self-delusion, self-seeking. Self is what I think I need or want in the basic instinct areas of my life. Joe and Charlie taught me that it's the way I think, my ambitions for the future, and what I desire in the areas of sex, security, and society, which is where I think I fit in to the world around me. And this usually causes all my problems. And thanks to intoxicated behavior most of the time, I have completely lost sight of what is a proper amount in any of these areas. In some cases, I was not taught properly because the person doing the teaching didn't understand. So I've gotten way out of line in these areas. By not being able to see the truth and by becoming intoxicated, I have demanded more than my fair share of a lot of this. So therefore, I delude myself, or I lie to myself. I don't know the truth about how much I either want or need. I seek more than I could possibly use in most cases, and I whine and cry and pity myself when I don't get what I think I want. So that's what builds the fear. That's where the 100 forms of fear come from. It's just simply me not getting what I want or what I think I now need, because my wants and my needs have become so mixed up. And this is a God-directed world, and I'm getting ready to ask God to direct me as well. And where am I going to ask Him to direct me? I'm going to ask Him to direct my thinking in these areas of self, sex, security, and society, and all of the little branches that we go to in there. By sex, I don't necessarily mean much about the sex act. Mostly it's fear with me, and so it's in my thinking. With money, it is, again, mostly fear.
I was talking this morning about a resident of this great city down in Atlanta, Elton John. And I said that even Elton John could have a sense of economic insecurity. No matter how much money a man had on this earth, he could still be devastated and paralyzed by economic insecurity. So I'm beginning to, I need to know what's wrong with these things before I can ask God to repair them. And what do I mean by directed? Well, simply, what do I need in these areas? God directs a lot of things. God directs everything but my thinking, because I decided that I was going to run that show myself. Especially since I became an alcoholic, I did not see the need for any guidance or direction. But God has been doing a wonderful job directing almost everything in this world except my thinking. He tells the bushes when to sprout, and He tells the trees when to bud. And I recall that about every spring we'll have a late frost, and everyone will say, "Oh my goodness, there goes all the flowers and all the fruit. We're not going to have anything to eat." Well, we've always had plenty to eat, and the flowers are always seem to be beautiful. So I believe God is doing a wonderful job in that area, even though I seem to continually be second-guessing Him. Now I'm going to ask God to direct my thinking. God has always been willing to do that. He gave me a will so that I could take care of these basic instincts, but since I didn't use it properly, I lost sight of the truth. So now that I have learned a little bit more about what self is, then when I see the word self, I know what they're talking about, and I know what that other word that's connected to it is talking about when it comes to me and my thinking. Because I know where I'm beginning to understand where I think rightly and where I do not think so rightly. Whatever the reason, we're not concerned about the reason right now. We'll get to that later. On page 63, when we sincerely took such a position, all sorts of remarkable things followed. We had a new employer. Being all-powerful, He provided what we needed if we kept close to Him and performed His work well. And that's what we're going to learn to do. Established on such a footing, we became less and less interested in ourselves, our little plans and designs. More and more, we became interested in seeing what we could contribute to life. As we felt new power flow in, as we enjoyed peace of mind, as we discovered we could face life successfully, as we became conscious of His presence, we began to lose our fear of today, tomorrow, or the hereafter. We were reborn.
We've had a renewing of the mind. That's what it means when it says we were reborn. We were reborn in the way we think.
And we're going to learn to do this so that we can have peace of mind. Power is another word that we begin to talk about a lot. And I am a power-hungry individual. I find it very necessary to have power in order to feel okay with me. And I have used a lot of wrong things to get this power, or the illusion of this power. And I'm not likely to let go of something that I think is working until I have a suspicion that something else is going to work for me. And these people knew that, and God knew that, and that's the way this is done, the way it is. If I have something that I think is making me feel okay, I'm not likely to let go of it, even though it's a total lie, even though resentments and fears have been where I've been getting my power, and they are not working. I do not really know that yet. So it says, we were now at step three. Many of us said to our Maker as we understood Him, "God, I offer myself to Thee, to build with me, and to do with me as Thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do Thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of Thy power, Thy love, and Thy way of life. May I do Thy will always." We thought well before taking this step, making sure we were ready, that we could at last abandon ourselves utterly to Him. And I notice in that prayer that I'm going to ask God to do the things that I've been trying to do, and it just didn't work because I do not have the needed power to do those things. We found it very desirable
Go ahead. Did you take a break?
Yeah, I was just going to tell about the first law of wing walking. You know, y'all know what wing walking is, of course.
Mm-hmm.
The first law of wing walking is you don't turn loose of nothing until you got a hold of something better.
That would probably work. We found it very desirable to take this spiritual step with an understanding person, such as our wife, best friend, or spiritual advisor. Now, my wife and best friend weren't very understanding at times, but my spiritual advisor, this worked very well. But it is better to meet God alone than with one who might misunderstand. The wording was, of course, quite optional, so long as we expressed the idea, voicing it without reservation. This was only a beginning, though if honestly and humbly made, an effect, sometimes a very great one, was felt at once. We are already possibly beginning to feel the power, because we have understood that there is nothing we can do about this, and now we're going to apply to have something done about it.
In Chuck C's book, A New Pair of Glasses, he talks about the prodigal son as, you know, as if he were an alcoholic. And he said that this alcoholic, this prodigal son, went to the father and demanded his inheritance, and he got it all. He said, "I want everything coming to me," and he got it, and he went off and spent it in riotous living. And he wound up sleeping and living with the hogs and eating what they ate. And he was a Jewish boy, see, and Jewish boys don't like hogs. They don't have much to do with them. But he got to thinking one day that in his father's mansion there were many houses and many rooms, and that the servants was living a lot better than he was living, so he decided to go home. And he said when he stood up and made a decision to go home to the living God that made him, to his father's mansion, that God saw him coming from a long way off and got up and went to meet him. Now, in my opinion, that's exactly what happens in Alcoholics Anonymous when we take step three. You know, there's no way I can make a fact-finding, fact-facing moral inventory of the way I think by myself. I'm going to have God's help. So when I make this decision and I pick up that pencil, I believe God sees me coming and He starts on His way to come to me to help me get through this thing. And any time that I get in trouble or I get, you know, get to where I'm in a strain, I always try to remember that I'm not in this thing by myself anymore. I've got some help. I talked to an old boy that was a friend of Charlie's that out in Oklahoma that owed a humongous amount of money. And he started paying that money back a little bit at a time. And I think it took something like 20 years to get it all paid. But he got it paid. And he said when he started, he had no idea that he could ever do it. But he remembered that he's not in this thing by himself anymore. That things happen and it works. Next, we launched out on a course of vigorous action. Now we're going to start taking action. I remember one time I was up at the old high place, and Dude was there, and she was asking me what was wrong, and I told her, and she said I had to get into action. And I said, "Now, Dude, I don't think you understand everything that I've been doing in AA. You know, I'm the equipment manager at Gym City. I'm the intergroup rep for this group, and I'm the GSR for this group. And I'm sponsoring three or four people, and there's three or four people sponsoring me. And I just going to two meetings a day, you know, sometimes three. And I really don't have time to do anything else." And she said, "That's not what I'm talking about, Bob. That's activity. That's just activity in AA. I'm talking about getting into action in the program itself." The first step of action now, the first step of which is a personal house cleaning, which many of us had never attempted. I certainly had never attempted a house cleaning. Personally, because, I mean, you know, I didn't need it before I got here. Though our decision was a vital and crucial step, the third step is a vital and crucial step. It could have little permanent effect unless at once followed by a strenuous effort to face and be rid of the things in ourselves which have been blocking us. Our liquor was but a symptom, so we had to get down to causes and conditions. Therefore, we started upon a personal inventory. This was step four. A business which takes no regular inventory usually goes broke. Taking a commercial inventory is a fact-finding and fact-facing process. It is an effort to discover the truth about the stock in trade. One object is to disclose damaged or unsaleable goods to get rid of them promptly and without regret. If the owner of the business is to be successful, he cannot fool himself about the values. Now, Bill is going to compare a personal inventory with a business inventory. He knows we've never made a personal inventory, but he thinks we might know something about a business inventory. So he uses that as an example to show us what we need to be doing. Taking a commercial inventory is a fact-finding, fact-facing process. And that's what we're going to do with the way we think. We're going to take a fact-finding, fact-facing, true inventory of the way we think. Somewhere along the line, we got the idea that it was a list of dirty, rotten, filthy things. And that's the kind of inventory that I made to start with. I made a list of dirty, rotten, filthy things, about several pages of what they had done to me, and a paragraph or two about what I had done to them. But I didn't understand it, see, so when I got through with that, I took it to a priest and read it to him, and he prayed the prayer of absolution for me, and I left there thinking, what good did that do? I didn't learn anything. I already knew all that stuff that I had written down. I thought that was step five. I thought I wrote out the dirty, rotten, filthy things that I had done and had been done to me, and then I took it to someone and read it to them, and I had completed step four and five. Now, we've had people come to the goose hung high when we're talking about step four and five, and we talk about the way it is in this book, and they come up to me after the meeting and say, I wish to hell I'd never come over here. I wish I had never come here and heard what y'all are talking about tonight. Because I thought I had done step four and five, and I'm seeing that I have done nothing. Well, that's exactly the way I was. I thought I had done step four and five. Based on my own knowledge of step four and five, and what I picked up and what I heard, I didn't ask nobody. And the reason that I didn't ask nobody is because I was afraid they were going to tell me that I hadn't done it right. So I just didn't ask them. And when they talked about step four and five in the meetings, I had already done that. See, I had already done that, so there was no need of me even listening much. We did exactly the same thing with our lives. We took stock honestly. We're talking about a moral inventory now. We're looking at the truth. We're going to look at this stock honestly. First, we searched out the flaws in our makeup, which caused our failure. Being convinced again that self, like Butch was talking about, manifested in various ways was what had defeated us, we considered its common manifestations. Resentment is the number one offender. It destroys more alcoholics than anything else. From it stem all forms of spiritual disease, for we have not only been mentally and physically ill, we have been spiritually sick. When the spiritual malady is overcome, and they tell me that the spiritual malady is overcome in steps 1, 2, and 3. Now, I questioned that for a while because I didn't understand what they were talking about. But I see now that that's true. I feel better about me, and I feel better about you, and my relationship with God as I understand God began when I understood what my problem was and what my solution would have to be. And I made a decision. So I feel, I know now that I'm not all guilty, not crazy, not sorry, not all those things that I thought I was before I began a spiritual journey in steps 1, 2, and 3. I see that I had a disease, a physical, mental disease which caused me to be spiritually sick. When the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. And they tell me that we straighten out mentally in steps 4 through 8. We straighten out the way we think in steps 4 through 8. And physically, with the world around us, not just our corporeal body, but the world around us and the way we handle other people and deal with other people, in steps 6, 7, 8, and 9. In dealing with resentment, we set them on paper. We listed people, institutions, or principles with whom we were angry. We ask ourselves why we were angry. We wrote down, and you know, I honestly believe, I knew 2 weeks before I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, I knew who I was mad at. But I kept confusing the issue so I wouldn't have to do it. As long as I don't understand what I'm doing, I don't have to do it, do I? I can put it off until I understand it better. And somebody finally, Speedy, probably told me that you don't understand it till you do it. And I got a little thing written down here that says, I hear and I forget. I see and I begin to suspect. I do and then I understand. Until I wrote these resentments down and made the observations that the step asked me to make, I had no earthly idea what y'all were talking about. I didn't have any resentments. I resented the fact that you wanted to talk about resentment. I remember one night I left a meeting and I told somebody, I said, if y'all don't quit talking about resentments, I've started making up things. You know, I'm not angry at anybody, but I've started making up resentments that I'm supposed to have. Until I took that pencil and started writing resentments, I realized that I was mad as hell at everybody. Everything. I hate, you know, the Internal Revenue Service wound up on my resentment, fear, sex. It wound up on all those lists because I'd been screwing them people for a long time. And I just knew if I started getting honest, they was going to find me out and catch up with me. And they did. And they did. But it wasn't no big deal because, remember, I'm not in this thing by myself anymore. If I've learned anything in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I think what I need to learn is that it's not what happens to me, because things do happen. Things have happened to me. But it's the way I react to them. It's the way I react to what happens to me. You know, I thought when we did this inventory and we did all these other things that now on I would never, ever, ever have any more problems. I wouldn't be angry. I wouldn't be afraid. I wouldn't harm nobody anymore. I wouldn't have no more guilt and no more shame and no more remorse. And when I started incorporating these principles in my life, and all of a sudden I find out that I'm still got resentments, and I'm still angry as hell sometimes, and I'm still scared to death sometimes, and I still hurt people, my immediate thought is just like it was when I got here. I'm not capable of having this thing. I'm not good enough to have this thing. I can't do it. I'm not doing it right. I'll have to do it even more. I'll have to work even harder at it. I have to work even more harder at it. Instead of just doing the things that the program tells me to do and let it happen. I remember sitting in a meeting one night and it dawned on me the first time in my life, this is one thing you're going to have to do, but you're going to have to let it happen to you. You can't push it. You can't make it happen. I thought when they said you had to have a spiritual experience, I said, get out the damn way, boys, because I'm fixing to have one. I'll show you a fish. I'll change. I'll walk on the water or something. But I'll have me a spiritual experience if that's what you want me to have. And, you know, I learned that didn't work. I tried all the reasons. I read all the books and listened to the music and did the affirmations and did all those things that you do, you know, when you're trying to have a spiritual experience. Yeah.
Hold that thought.
Hold that thought. hold a tiger,